thought nine, Elliot Friedman, about number 68, mm-hmm. Yaromir Jagr.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting points in all of this, too, is there wasn't that one farewell. There wasn't that one send-off. This is the last game. See you later. This isn't Jerome Iginla sending out the Calgary Flames to shake Trevor Linden's hand because they know it's his last game in the NHL. He's just gone and playing a Kladno now. When you're going to look back at Jagr's career, and I think a lot of us have already started to do this, you know, even previous him going to Calgary, if not Florida. But before that, what's going to come to mind for you right away?
Well, I think anybody who looks at Jagr's career and say, oh, I didn't like the way it ended.
I hate that.
I think you've got a terrible perspective on life, to be perfectly honest. This is but a small footnote in a Hall of Fame history to me. What am I going to remember? I always remember the first time I ever really had a chance to see him up close and talk to him. And it was in 1997, training camp. I went from the Score to do some features on some teams. And one of the teams I went to go do was Pittsburgh. And as Jagr prepared for me to interview him at his stall, he put on his shirt with the hangers still in it on purpose. And he walked around with them, and they were like laughing. Oh, that's Yarmer. And, you know, I think obviously I'll remember all the great plays. I mean, like, is there like one Jagr play that stands out to you, or is it just the overall accumulation?
There's a couple in Pittsburgh where he danced everybody.
Well, Chicago in the Stanley Cup Final.
We're in the Stanley Cup Final for the second year in a row, and here's Jagr with the puck. Jagr, nice move around Brent Sutter to the backhand. Let's it go. He scores!
Well, this is the one thing that team defense cannot defend against. Great individual efforts. He beat one guy, Dirk Graham, then a second player. Now he's going to beat a third Hawk and make him look bad. Use Sean McEachern as a screen because McEachern was tied up with Kravchuk. And then a backhand shot. Fabulous individual efforts. And I don't care how good the team is defensively as a team, that becomes man on man. And Jagr just beat three of them.
That was the one I think I would remember, but I don't look at him as a specific play, as just a fantastic career.
I look at the career, I think we all do, but the one thing that will jump out at me, and I'll always think this way about Jagr, kind of in the same way that I look at, this might sound like a stretch, but George Foreman, in that here's someone that changed the conversation around him pretty fast.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, once upon a time, Jagr was this highly skilled player who was pouty and moody and self-absorbed. Like, we're so far removed from the guy in Washington who wouldn't do line rushes with his teammates in warm-up. Like, mm-hmm. we're so far removed from that guy. I'm always impressed with the athlete that changes the story about himself. And somewhere along the road, he turned into this lovable nomad who was, you know, sprinkling Czech fairy dust over players like Claude Giroux. You know, everywhere he went, trying to make younger players better, whether it was Barkov and Huberdeau in Florida. To me, how quickly the story about Jagr changed from the pouty, moody guy to the lovable, surefire Hall of Famer that everybody loves. That's, to me, is going to stand out about Jagr.
Well, I think there's a couple of things there. Number one, it's not a cookie-cutter world anymore. You know, Jagr came in at a time when the NHL was evolving from the players having no power and coaches having all the power to players having a lot more power. And also at that time, like, one coach coached 25 guys the same way. Hey, there's no special people. You do it my way or you're gone. And now it's, you recognize, okay, this is how you motivate player A. This is how you motivate player B. Player C is very strong mentally. Player D needs to be handled differently. And also, we have a greater understanding of the fact that when you come to North America from a foreign country, we know what the adjustment is. I think if Yarmir Jagr was a rookie now, as opposed to in 1991 or whatever year it was.
1990.
I think he'd be even better. I think teams would have a better idea of how to deal with him at an early age. And he admitted that He had some insecurities. He wasn't the most confident guy, still isn't at times. I think we would have had a much better idea of how to deal with him.
You know, you said a couple of seconds ago about, you know, this idea that, oh, you know, leave the stage while they're still clapping. You know, you're tarnishing your reputation by hanging on.
I don't buy that.
Man, I'll tell you, and I loved Peter Forsberg for this.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Forsberg, as we all recall, had a foot issue, couldn't find a boot that really fit right for him, couldn't perform. But he never stopped trying. He tried every single boot that was out there. You know, he would put a tuck blade on Cinderella's slipper just in case it worked, just mm-hmm. to go out there, just because he was not ready to leave the game then. And in a game where we're constantly saluting a never say die attitude and whatever it takes, get back there on the ice, you got to extend your shift, you got to block the shot. Why, when it comes to veterans and Hall of Fame guys, do we have a hard time letting them leave on their own terms? Why do we always
I'm
want
not
them
like
to?
That.
I know you're not, but I'm saying in general. I hate this idea that, oh, you're tarnishing your reputation.
Oh,
nonsense.
Stupid.
I think that Forsberg enhances reputation. Guys that have to be dragged off the ice, give me that guy on my team any day of the week.
You know, it's funny. I was talking to Michael Hutchinson last night, and I said to him, you know, despite everything that's happened to you this year and your disappointments, do you think you're going to be dragged off the ice? And he goes, yes. Yes, I am. Like, someone's going to have to do that to me. I remember Michael O'Shea, the linebacker who's now coaching in Winnipeg in the Canadian Football League. He was that way. I saw an interview once. The first guy I really remember retiring near the top of his game was Mike Schmidt. Now, when I was a kid, and for those of you who don't know who Mike Schmidt is, he was a third baseman for the Philadelphia Phillies. Is a Hall of Famer. He was a great hitter.
A bajillion home runs.
And he was a great fielder, too. He won a ton of gold gloves. And he retired in the late 80s in, like, May, out of nowhere. And he just walked up to the microphones, and Mike Schmidt was a really opinionated guy. And he said, I just don't think I'm Mike Schmidt anymore, and I can't stand it. And I respect that, too.
Hmm.
I once told that story about someone, and they said to me, you know who's going to do that in the NHL? And I said, who? And he goes, Nicholas Lidstrom.
He did.
The moment that Nicholas Lidstrom feels he's not Nicholas Lidstrom anymore, he is going to walk.
Some point in time, catches up with everyone and diminishes their ability to perform something you love and care about passionately, comes to an end sooner than what you would have liked. The last 2 years, I waited until after the season was over to assess my ability to play another year. I need to let a few weeks go by to get a reading on my body's ability to recover from the grind of an NHL season. Sadly, this year, it's painfully obvious to me that my strength and energy level are not rebounding enough for me to continue to play. It's not that the tank is completely empty. I just doesn't have enough to carry me through every day at that high level where I want to play at. My family and I are completely comfortable with this decision. Retiring today allows me to walk away from the game with pride rather than having the game walk away from me. So, thank you very much.
And he did.
Interesting point about Lidstrom, too. He's still in the conversation for the Norris, and he walked away.
Yes.
Like, that is such an underreported story, I think, when it comes to the lore of Lidstrom.
Mm-hmm.
He's still in the balloting for the Norris, and he says, I'm not me anymore. I need to go.
You know, I think there were other things, like his kids were getting older.
Sure, of course.
But I do have a certain amount of respect for the Mike Schmidts and Nicholas Lidstroms of the world who say, I'm not me anymore, and I don't want to see it.
Bobby Holík. I remember when Bobby Holík retired and having a conversation with him, and I said, well, you know, so you're retired now. Because what happens when a lot of these guys retire is all their buddies come out of the woodwork and want them to play on their men's league team.
Yeah.
All of a sudden you get recruited because, hey, that's it, man. That's a combination for winning the championship. The ex-NHLer shows up. Even if he's going half speed, we're going to win the whole thing. And I said, you know, are you still playing some pickup? Are you playing with the guys and all that? And he said, I can't play hockey. I said, you know, you didn't leave because of anything, you know, necessarily physical about you. He said, listen, I only know how to play one way. And that's the only way I can play. That, to me, is hockey. And if I can't play it that way, I'm not going to play at all. And I can't play like that in a recreational league. So I'm just not going to play.
Leo Routens was like that. When I first started covering sports professionally, my first things I did was basketball. And we used to play a pickup game, the media, you know, at the beginning. Like, they'd have their training camp, and we'd play a game towards the end of training camp. And needless to say, you weren't going to be confusing the media playing and the players scrimmaging. But Leo Routens wouldn't play. And I asked him once, I said, well, how come you don't join us? You know, you're more than welcome.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, Elliot, like, I still feel I could still play, and I don't want to do that.
That's not me anymore.
And I got it. Like, I remember initially somebody saying, like, you know, what a jerk. And I said, nope, I get that. I know where he's coming from. You know, the one thing I'd like to add on this Yager thing, though, I have a lot of thoughts about the All-Star weekend. So Super Bowl weekend's coming up, and we're all going to watch that. And the week after Super Bowl is the NBA All-Star Weekend. And this year it's in Los Angeles. And Los Angeles hosted a great NHL All-Star Weekend last year with the top 100. It was a great event. But I'm going to watch the NBA All-Star Weekend. And I went to the game in Toronto when it was there a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't understand why the players in the NBA all want to be there. Even if you're not invited, you're there, you're in your best suit, you're sitting courtside, you're going nuts at the dunk competition, you're going crazy at the three-point competition, and in the NHL, these players, they fight not to go. And I think it is incumbent on the league and the Players Association, if we really want to make the All-Star game as great as it can be, we have to make it the kind of party that the players want to go to, even if they're not playing.
Let's pick up that conversation here in a couple of moments. Welcome to 31 Thoughts, the podcast.
Colby Armstrong, Elliot, 31 thoughts. Thank God you're doing this podcast because I was get to about 15 thoughts and shut her down. Jeff Merrick, when I was bragging that I was working with you, Crosby said to me, hey, isn't that the iDesk guy?
Okay, so Elliot, anytime you can fit an Undertaker reference into 31 thoughts, I always appreciate it. But I did like, we'll pick up this conversation just before the open there. You were talking about making it incumbent upon these superstars of the game
not
to
even
all
the superstars.
Be there.
Like, everybody should feel welcome. Like, not just the superstars, but like, hey, if you're a third line player, fourth line player, you want to go to All-Star Weekend, just be part of the festivities, be there. And one of the things you do, I think, is you start bringing in the specialists.
That's what I wanted to get to. But I want to pause on your idea about, okay, you're a third line right winger.
Yeah.
You want them there.
Yes.
Just there to be part of the event.
Absolutely.
Just to do an ISO on them in the second period. Hey, look, here's Jason Pominville is here at the game or whomever.
Yes. Or, you know what? You stand at the door when people walk in. You're taking selfies. You're shaking hands. You're kissing babies. Maybe you walk around during the game or the competition or the dead time. Hey, my name is, to steal okay. one from Bob McCowan, Claude Thamelfichuk of the Winnipeg Jets. Thanks for coming. Do you want to take a picture? Do you want a selfie? Do you want an autograph?
So then, because you know this culture a lot better than I do.
Yeah.
What is the difference then? Why are basketball players interested in that where hockey players aren't?
You know,
players are always looking for the getaway. I got to get out for a few days. I'm going down south.
That's one thing. There's no question about that.
But why should it be
different? You know, I think hockey is, and I'm not saying, I hate this people who say basketball is a wimpy sport. It's not. It's a tough sport. But hockey is a more physically demanding sport. And I could see guys saying, you know, we really want our time. But you've got a lot of time now. You get a five-day break. You got four days off a month at least as part of the new CBA. The other thing, too, is I don't know. Are the parties not good enough? Like, the NBA parties are outrageous.
Oh, they're legendary.
Like,
when it was here in Toronto,
outrageous.
Even I'm hearing about them.
But you know what? I heard Flo Rida was great the other night. Joey Vendetta puts on good parties. Like, I just think, you know, I'm lockouted out is what I'm saying. Like, there was a time I really dove deep into the labor stories between the league and the Players Association. During the last lockout in 2013, I had several people come up to me on both sides, and even managers in the league say, boy, you did a great job of keeping us informed. But by the end of it, Jeff, I was done. I am not interested in doing that again. And now when there becomes the battles between the league and the players, I almost don't care. And I love almost every story. I almost don't care now. So when people say to me, well, the league and the players aren't getting along, so this will never get done, to me, that's just a BS story. Do you want to grow the league, or do you want to complain about the league not getting enough growth? So to me, one of the ways you can make the league look better is, what do we have to do to make it so that the players who even aren't invited want to come down to All-Star Weekend and be part of it? I want to see players who are not playing there. Kiss babies. Give them free tickets. Make them part of the weekend.
I think that
make
needs,
it big.
That needs for me. That needs to be an initiative not by the NHL to encourage these players, but the NHL Players Association.
And it
there
should
has
be on
to be
each
something
other too.
From players are so reluctant. Oh, the NHL wants me to go to this thing. I'm not obliged, so I'm not going to. But when it comes from the Players Association, is that not different? Is that not a different hammer? Is there not something the PA can
sure it could
create for them?
Absolutely. But I just look at it this way. I'm tired of saying, well, this is the NHL's job or this is the Players Association's job. If you want to grow the game now, it is your job as a person in the game. It is everybody's job. Nobody escapes it. Like next year in San Jose, as I wrote, I don't care if Joe Thornton and Joe Pavelski and Patrick Marleau are all-stars. Get them there. Have them do something in the skills competition. Bring Jágr back next year. Give him one big ovation.
You mentioned the individual players.
Yes.
And personalizing them for the skills competition.
Yes.
I love this. And from whatever corner I've ever spoken from, I've talked about this. The idea of bringing in specialists for the event. So just because Zdeno Chara is not there at the All-Star Game doesn't mean he shouldn't participate in the skills competition.
Shea Weber, too.
If Shea Weber, if you're going to do a trick shot competition, there's no reason that Robbie Schrempf, hey, remember him? First round draft pick, Oilers, London Knights, all of that shouldn't be involved there. Or you bring in, I mean, how many videos does everyone see of Pavel Barber? Every single week,
mm-hmm.
right? And one of the great stick handling online phenomenons.
Yes.
Why not bring him in?
Who was the kid that Healy showed last week?
Oh, I didn't see. Who did
Healy
show?
There was a young kid who was all over Twitter. I can't remember his name.
Oh,
he was wearing
number
a Crosby jersey.
Oh, I saw that. Yeah, in his backyard.
Find the kid and bring him over.
Totally.
Should have written that today.
All that kind of stuff. I mean, but those guys pop up all the time.
Yeah.
Right? Online. Certainly on YouTube. Bring those guys in for it.
Bring Barzal. Guys don't want to skate against McDavid. Bring Barzal in.
No, you know how you do it? You do it like the end of Slapshot. No one wants to compete against Connor McDavid for the fastest. I like your idea of not announcing them. So all of a sudden, you know, the arena goes dark. Out comes Andreas Athanasiou. The whole place goes dark. Out comes Dylan Larkin. Matthew Barzal.
All
of a sudden, here come the hired guns to try to beat Connor McDavid in a race.
And McDavid goes last. Or, you know, if he wants, he could go first. I'll set the tone.
I like him going last. I like a chase.
Yeah.
I like that guy to be the one that's chasing. But regardless, I mean, essentially what you're doing is you're dressing this up pro wrestling style from a marketing point of view.
Yes.
And that is money in the bank.
Oh, I like the wrestling reference. Now, what do you think about alumni doing it?
Oh, I love it.
Like,
Healy's
running the NHL alumni now.
You
and
tell
he's
me you
big in it.
You wouldn't want to see alumni guys doing the shooting and doing the skating, or maybe even bring in one of those guys. Listen, man. Because I see him all the time at NTR. Mike Gartner can still go.
Yeah, he said no.
Did he?
I texted him and I said,
"Would you want to do it?"
He texts back because Elliot, I'm 58.
Doesn't matter. Have you seen him skate still?
Oh, I bet you he could. But you know, I have Freddy said he would be interested
for the hardest shot.
Yeah,
see, I love that.
See, he said I need to get into shape, and I go, "Could you hit 100?" And he goes, "Well, I'm not going to say I could break any records, but yeah, I think I could."
Alumni skills competition.
No.
You mix with these guys. But even aside, if you're not going to do that, why not alumni skills competition?
And is there something that you could have players judge? Because I think that's one of the fun things also about the NBA All-Star Weekend is the
judge
the dunks. Is there something you get like?
There used to be with the trick shot competition, you could judge it. I just don't know what event you have now that you could judge. Because essentially you're talking about aesthetics.
Right. But at the end of the day, I really believe, Jeff, that the big thing about the All-Star Weekend is they should be encouraging more players to go.
So is that your big takeaway from Tampa?
Yeah. You know what? Like, I got to tell you, like, people hate All-Star. I like it more and more every year. I got to tell you, I thought Columbus with that big slide out front of the arena,
yeah.
I loved it. Nashville's Nashville. I mean, if you don't have a good time in Nashville, you're a loser. L.A. was great because the 100th anniversary, they did such a fantastic job with the alumni. And Tampa's a fun place, and Gasparilla was hilarious.
That looked like fun.
Like, it's just funny to walk around and see all that stuff. And you know what? I love the skills competition. I think they got to tone it down. I thought it was a little bit too long. But, you know, you got to sell your game. And skills competitions do well. And I think there is more for the league and its players to do here. And people say get rid of the All-Star game or make it outdoors. And the league's like, no, because it's a standalone event and people still want it and the sponsors still love it, and which I get. So let's improve it. Let's make it bigger and better.
Would you change the color of the ice?
I don't know if I would do that.
Ah.
No, but like, okay, but what are you doing it for?
We talked about R&D camps. And you and I have had this conversation before, and we differ on it. And I look at those Pacific uniforms, which are all white with one orange stripe sock.
Or it was pink, I think, actually.
Okay. And I look at the ice, and it's 200 by 85 of white. And I'm saying to myself, everything is washing.
Yeah, that's fair.
This is all washing. And I can recall going to Buffalo in the lockout 2005. And I want to say it might have been Larry Quinn's idea. I know the AHL fined them for it. Because they didn't get permission to do it. It was a regular season game.
Dave Andrews, he runs a tough fiefdom, man.
I remember he told me, he's like, yeah, it's a neat thing, but we dinged him for it because Larry never checked it out with us. it was Rochester Americans against the St. John's Maple Leafs. Okay, so it's lockout. You start for hockey. So I'm going down to this thing. And they're doing blue ice, right? So it's baby blue. And they changed the blue lines to orange, okay? Now, Black Puck still shows up fine on baby blue. And I thought, for a live event, this is great. So I'm watching. I'm thinking, okay, this looks pretty good. Let me go in the concourse, look and see how it looks on television. It looked fantastic. And here's my point through all of it. When you look at growing the game and making it more appealing, you know, I look at how I'm not a huge golf fan, but I'll watch golf because when I sit down and put it on television, it's relaxing my eyes.
Yeah.
The lush green. Say that for football. You can say that for baseball. Basketball has its own colors as well. In hockey, we take the worst TV color and splash it all over the screen in white. And then we have white jerseys on top of that.
Yeah.
It's harsh on the eyes. So even if you don't like it for the NHL, would, Elliot, you at least try it at the All-Star game?
You have talked me into considering it.
I'm getting closer. Now you're considering it.
Well, I'd like to see what it is.
I mean, a lot of minor league teams and CHL teams will do pink the rink for breast cancer. So we've seen that before. We've seen different
colors. I have no problem with that.
That.
You want to pink the rink and make it part of, like, maybe you make it part of your Hockey Fights Cancer. I know it's in November, but we do something special at the All-Star game.
Yep.
I'm good with that. Now, what did you think of the skills competition?
I loved it.
Yeah, I thought it was a little long.
You know what? I'm fine with it.
Yeah, I thought it was a little long. But I liked the ideas they tried.
We took the kids to see Jumanji, and then afterwards I had nothing to do that night, so I watched all of it.
Did you like Jumanji?
I love Jumanji. Yeah. But then again, I'm a big Dwayne Johnson guy.
Yeah, The Rock, he's awesome.
It was fantastic.
I'm really looking forward to Black Panther. It's getting great reviews.
Oh, yes, indeed. I like the skills competition, and I like seeing Hillary Knight. You know, I thought that was a real nice touch.
You know, that I got to tell you, that is one of the biggest things that I've noticed that's changed in hockey in the last 10 to 15 years is how much better the women shoot the puck.
Mm-hmm.
And watching Hillary Knight, that really cemented it for me because it was right below where we were sitting.
Quick story before we get to Doug McLean. He's going to join us in a couple of moments. I recently got to share the ice with Marie-Philippe Poulin.
Yep.
And, I mean, she's remarkable, phenomenal hockey player. And we're doing, like, target shooting, and she was just, you know, money in the bank. I can remember a story. This would have been at Team Canada orientation camp before the Vancouver Games. So it was Calgary, summer 2009. And I was there, and the women were coming on the second day to skate. The men had gone on in the morning. The women were skating, and I was standing with Steve Koulias and Craig Button.
Mm-hmm.
And we're watching, and the women are skating, and everyone's sort of filing in and having a look, and okay, yeah, whatever, we got to go get change. Vincent LeCavalier comes by and stands beside me and Cooley, and he watches for a while. And they're doing a shooting drill, and Marie-Philippe is just like, she's nailing it. She's
firing
like
it.
18 years old at this point. She's like the next big thing in Canadian women's hockey. And he says, who's 29? I said, oh, that's Marie-Philippe Poulin. She's like next to take the mantle from Haley and Cassie as the next, you know, phenom in Canadian women's hockey. And he pauses for a second. He says, that's an effing hockey player. And he turns his back and goes into the dressing room. Was the only guy that stayed to watch all of it. That's the one. And it was shooting drills.
He's a good scout, Vince.
Not bad. Doug McLean joins us next.
Sportsnet.ca, your online home for everything sports. Dunks, dives, and deeks. Catch highlights, news, and the best storytelling in Canada. Featuring all the stories you want to read in one place. Plus, exclusive podcasts including 31 Thoughts and At the Letters. Canada's deepest roster of storytellers. Sportsnet.ca, your online home for everything sports.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Chalk Talk with Red Wing assistant Doug McLean.
There goes a piece of the roof on live television.
Are you all right?
On live television, the studio just fell apart.
I thought we were attacked.
I thought. Okay, for those listening on...
McLean is retired from live TV finally.
For those listening on the radio...
Don't try that at home, folks.
A piece of the ceiling in our studio... A big panel just fell down and narrowly missed hitting Doug in the head.
Oh,
and
it was... cancel the show?
Doug McLean begins his day like any other, with an early morning jog. Trade talks are stalled, and who will be available sixth overall remains unclear.
People say you solve problems. I create problems when I'm running, so I come back from the jog and I'm totally screwed up and really worried then.
Doug does seem worried.
The cannon, of course, has become synonymous with the Blue Jackets since it was first unveiled here back in 2007. It's one of the men that was behind this cannon idea, former Blue Jackets general manager Doug McLean. Here he is now with Jeff Merrick.
Now, that cannon, Doug McLean, at Nationwide Arena has become a staple post-goal celebration. Give us the origin story. What's the genesis of the cannon?
One day I was sitting in my office, and I knew I was on the verge of getting fired within a couple of days, and I get this email from a jacket backer saying, we'd love to have the cannon, and I thought, you know what? What the heck? I walk down the hallway, and I say to the VP of business guy, what? Let's do the cannon. 2 days later, I'm fired. They got the cannon.
Welcome to the show, Nick.
That was the worst opening to any show, radio or TV, in history.
Pleased to be joined now by someone who's done plenty, Elliot, in the NHL. Not just the NHL, but hockey as well. Played with the Montreal Juniors once upon a time. Was a pro in the St. Louis Blues organization. Worked as a... assistant coach with the St. Louis Blues, worked on the bench with the Detroit Red Wings, the Florida Panthers, the Columbus Blue Jackets, has been a general manager, has been a team president, has been an alternate governor. Is there anything I'm leaving out, Doug McLean?
Head coach of University of New Brunswick.
Can't forget about that one.
And that's the head coach of the Western Capitals in Summerside.
I know, and probably could have...
Which has had some famous coaches, by the way, the Western Capitals. I was their first head coach.
Want to run them down? What are they?
Dave Cameron was a head coach there. Mm-hmm. And Gerard Gallant was a head coach there. So they've had some pretty good coaches come through the Summerside Western Capitals organization.
And you probably
one less than you think.
And Errol Thompson was a head coach there.
Very nice. And you could have run for Premier in PEI, we understand. People tell me you would have won with zero platform.
No, I was offered the job as the leader of the opposition, though.
Do you think you could tolerate politics?
No. Are you kidding?
Like, I work next to you now. Since the last 2 years, we work Wednesdays together.
Is that all it's been is 2 years?
It seems like
a lifetime.
It's been 2000, yes. But I hear this. I didn't know that, by the way, until you mentioned it. If there is one person I know who is absolutely 1,000% not cut out for politics, it is you.
I agree 100%. That's what I told the group when I met with them, too.
That's actually a compliment, by the way.
Oh, yeah. I couldn't do it either.
No.
But you're less inclined to do it than me.
No. And as a matter of fact, I met... going through the Toronto airport, Robert Giz was the premier PEI.
His father was the premier too, right?
Yes.
Joe.
And Robert was the premier at the time when this rumor came out that they had asked me to run it. So I meet Robert Giz at the Toronto airport, and he stops me and he said, Doug, you're not serious. You wouldn't consider doing that, would you? And he was the guy I would have been running against. So he thought I was nuts to even consider it.
They said to me that he was scared of you.
No, I would say he was just trying to be a friend.
No, he was saying, I do not want to run against this guy. He might actually beat me.
No, I don't know about that, but anyway.
All right, Doug, I want to begin this interview by insulting you.
Okay.
If I may. Now, this is, I've read, I think, every single Dick Irvin book. I love reading Dick Irvin books. This is one that came out in 1997. It's called Tough Calls, NHL Referees and Linesmen Tell Their Stories.
Uh-oh.
Okay, ready for this? I want you to tell me which official is talking here.
Okay. Was it a referee or a linesman?
Stand by. Doug McClain is probably the most vocal coach in the NHL right now. The most intimidating to officials, although maybe not as intimidating as he thinks he is. His team, Florida, had Brian Skrudland as captain. You can talk to him on the ice, tell him that if his coach doesn't shut up, the team's going to suffer. With the other guys, you can say the same thing and have a real problem. By the time the message is delivered, the whole meaning has changed. The wire service in this league is very fast and very small. I try to think a bit now about what I say, and some nights I have to bite my tongue. Who is that talking about you?
Would it be Ron Asseltine?
Nope. It's a linesman, by the way.
It is a linesman?
It's a linesman.
I don't know. There's a lot of them hate him.
Scampanello?
Nope, not Scampi.
No, not Scampi. I got along good with Scampi. No, I don't know.
Leon Stickle.
You know what? Asseltine or Stickle. I knew it was one of the two.
Leon Stickle.
Yeah.
The first time I really met you, I didn't know you that well when you were, and I wasn't in the media that much in hockey when you were in your heyday. You were the general manager of Columbus. You guys came through Toronto for a late game, a late season game, and you got, I think, four penalties in the first period, and you stormed out of your booth into the press box at Air Canada Centre, and you bellowed to anyone who would listen, "I thought the referees hated Pat Quinn." And that was my first real introduction to Doug McClain.
I did a lot of dumb things that I regret. And Jill summed it up best with me one
time. That's your wife, by the way.
Yeah, Jill summed it up best with me. She said one day I come home from a game and I had made a fool of myself, I guess. And she said, you know, our kids do have to go to school. And, you know, Doug, maybe you have to be a little fairer than, a little smarter. But anyway, you know what? And I think back to, well, I got the great Steve Wacom story. You know, you'd phone the Coley Campbell, you'd phone Mike Murphy, or you'd phone Stephen Wacom. And Steve Wacom told me, last time I met him, he told me that he kept my voicemail on his phone for 3 years. One that I left him after a game one night ripping the referees because he said every time he wanted a good chuckle, he would play my voicemail. So I appreciated that I was able to help him. But you think back to some of
the greatest hits compilation,
some of the dumb
things
you did and some of the dumb ways you behaved, and you think, good grief. But you know what? I'm telling you guys, you have no idea how emotionally involved you become when you're a coach or a general manager. General manager may be tougher. And Coley always was terrific when I'd phone him or Murph. They'd always talk you off the ledge, but it you lived and died with every call. And I've said this to Gary Bettman since I got out of the league. I go to games now, or I watch games, I couldn't tell you who's refereeing. I don't even notice the referees in the game anymore. Whereas when I was a coach and a general manager, it drove me batty, and it was every whistle, every stop. And now I don't. And Gary said it to me. He said, you know, that's what it is. When you're emotionally away from the game itself, the referees become almost a non-factor. And that's the way I see them now.
Was that the first thing you'd look at when you'd get the game sheet? Would you be more interested in the starting lineup or who's officiating?
Oh, unbelievable who you'd check to see who. Is it Coho? What veterans were there that you say, okay, you know, we've got a really reasonable relationship. So you always check that. But when you're not emotionally involved, that's what tells me the referees are that good, because now I don't even notice them there.
You know, it's funny. When I first started, I covered basketball more in depth before I covered hockey. And one of the assistant coaches on the Raptors once showed me his book. And whenever he knew who the referees were, he pulled out the book and he would tell the head coach and the players, okay, here's how the game's going to get called tonight. This guy's going to do this. And that was early in my career. I was fascinated by that. But you know what you talked about there that really resonates with me is, it was one of the things I found most interesting about covering sports is how invested not only the players were, but the executives. And I'll tell a story. Jim Rutherford is always a guy who was very nice to me as I was starting out. He once pulled me aside and he said, you know, people notice how you work. And that's when I learned that people are always watching and evaluating everything you do. So he goes to the Stanley Cup Final in 2002 as the GM of the Carolina Hurricanes, and they lose Game 5 in Detroit, and Detroit wins the Cup. And he's walking by me, and I just tried to tap him and say, great run, great season. And I could tell by the way he looked at me, it was just the wrong thing to say. And the first time I saw him next year, I said to him, did I make a mistake there? And he goes, yes, you did. You should not have said anything to me in that moment. Mm-hmm. And, Doug, I was 31 years old and still pretty early in my career. But that was the moment it really hit me, Doug, about you guys living and dying as much as the players do.
Every call. And I go back and I see GMs today. And if you ever had a tape of the calls that go to hockey ops from the GMs, it would be gold. It would be gold. And I worked with Brian Murray, and Brian was a very calm guy. Yeah. Oh, my God, he'd get wound up over the referees, too. And I was on the bench with Brian for like almost 10 years, so I learned from one of the best. You know what? I always liked them, and I see the referees now, and I feel bad, but you know you've made some mistakes when every referee writes a damn book and you're in it.
It's just one paragraph of one book from 1997.
But I'm in a lot of them, I think.
Well, actually, you're in everyone's heart, too, when they look back on their career.
Now,
officials.
The other thing you said that was really interesting to me is you talked about what Jill said to your wife about your kids have to go to school. Mm-hmm. I was told that there is a general manager now who is not sure about keeping their position because of the toll the job takes on his wife and kids. How bad was it for yours?
It was bad. It was bad. And I was in management without Twitter. But right. We had these crazy things called HF boards. We're running around.
Oh, yeah, I know, HFboards.com. Yeah.
And you know what? I actually had a situation where Clark was getting teased at school.
Clark's your son.
You know, he was getting teased at school. And I actually had a person to come in and talk to Clark about dealing with this, dealing with the criticism, dealing with the kids.
Like a psychiatrist or a psychologist?
Well,
he was
a sports psychologist,
Okay.
friend of mine, and just come in as a friend. And he and Clark are still tremendous friends, but he came in and just went through it. I also had, lucky he had a teacher who, her father was the head coach of the Ohio State Buckeyes, John Cooper, who took a ton of heat.
Sure.
So it was tough. It was tough on the kids. And we used to sit and say to the kids, both of them, I said, you know, we have to understand that there's lots of benefits. You know, you hang around with the team, you're in the dressing room,
sure.
you know, you've got to take the good with the bad here. We've got to understand as a family that there's very positives here, but it's also tough at times. And it wasn't easy. The funniest story with my kids is, they published this thing in Florida when I was a coach of the Panthers, and they had the four coaches in Florida at the time were Pat Riley, making $2 million a year,
yep.
Jimmy Johnson, making $2 million a year, and the coach of the Marlins was Jimmy Leland.
And they won the World Series.
Won the World Series, and he was making like $1.5 million, and my salary was $450 at the time. Clark goes to school the next day, and the kids are teasing him about how your old man's really low paid. What a joke. And I remember him coming home saying, really? You know, it's embarrassing what you're paid.
Well, and
I thought, geez, that's a pretty good salary.
Feeling pretty good yourself. He's up against Riley.
So anyway, but as a family, we had a lot more positives than the negatives.
You did get best hair among all coaches in South Florida.
Yes, I did win that, which was against a pretty
Riley.
How do you beat Riley?
Oh, unbelievable.
Good luck.
Unbelievable. But when I get the job in Florida and I was like total nobody, and the marketing people, a week later, the Heat hired Pat Riley. And the feeling was, oh, my God, we got this nobody, and Pat Riley's coming to South Florida? What a disaster we have in our hands here.
How quickly could we get Bowman in here? Does anyone have his number really fast?
It was, and I'm there hearing all this stuff.
Did I sign already?
Hadn't even coached a game in there. The marketing people were mad they had me.
Let me ask you a follow-up question about your family, because you mentioned your son, Clark, and he works the agent side of the industry right now with Justin Duberman's organization out of Chicago. Because he played hockey, you know, he played himself all the way up. Yeah. Did you ever have any misgivings about him continuing in the hockey industry at all? Just knowing what you know about it, knowing how tough it is, knowing, listen, there's no guarantees to any of this. You've seen people fall off at various levels. Do you have any misgivings about that?
Never really, because he sort of was a guy that was around me so much as a kid. And He loved being in the dressing room and being around the team, and he loved the games. But it was tough, even as a little guy, when we got fired in Detroit. And one of the nicest things that's ever happened to Clark, Brian Murray and I get fired in Florida, or in Detroit. And I mentioned to Steve Yzerman. Steve Yzerman phoned me when I got fired and said, "Hey, sorry to hear, and all the best, everything." And I said, "Hey, Clark's devastated." He said, "I'm going to phone Clark." Mm. He was a kid, a little. Wow. And Stevie Y phoned Clark and said, "Hey, Clark, I hope you stay as a fan, of, you know." And Clark, it was like, wow.
Holy smokes.
So it was pretty cool. But I knew he would be in the business somewhere. But what surprised me is when he finished, he had opportunities in the coaching, and he really didn't. When he finished playing, he really didn't want to go into coaching. He sort of wanted to try to do his own thing, you know. So, you know, he's trying his own thing, and we'll see how it goes. But he follows the game. I used to get a kick at him. We'd be driving in the car. He could name every player in the NHL what every piece of equipment they wore.
Oh, he was that guy.
He knew the stick. He knew the gloves. He knew the helmet. He knew the skates. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, how do you know that stuff? It was weird. And as Jill used to say, why do you get him to focus as much on his school as he does on that?
I used to get that a lot from my parents.
Yeah. So anyway, it's, you know, as a family, we had so many great times that we sort of laugh about it now as a family. But
do you ever wish you could negotiate one contract against your kid?
How would that conversation go?
I'd just give him what he wanted. That's what I used to do anyway. I mean, so I was a general manager of an expansion team and never had one player ever take me to arbitration.
You never had one?
Or one player ever asked to be traded.
You never had a guy asked to be traded?
Never had one player in 9 2/3 years ever asked to be traded.
Now, we got Mike Fisher today. Did you ever try to bring a guy back out of retirement?
No, I tried to get a lot of guys to retire. Maybe you should quit.
Mike Keenan once tried to get Denny Potvin out of retirement to play with that Rangers squad that ended up winning the Stanley Cup in 94.
Dennis told me that story.
Yeah, and he, you know, reluctant. Now, that would have been quite the story.
The closest I came to that was I really thought I had Eric Lindros coming to Columbus.
And that's when he went to Toronto.
That's when he signed with Toronto. Yeah. And I talked to his dad, who was his agent. I talked to him a ton that summer. It came down to us and Toronto. But anyway, so that would be the closest I came to getting a guy to come back.
Speaking of Lindros, true or false, when you were with Detroit, the offer was Fedorov. When the Rangers were in and Philadelphia was in, that was a name that I had always heard bandied about.
I had been over scouting in Europe at the, I think it was the World Junior, and watched Forsberg. And I remember coming back, and Brian Murray saying to me, would you consider giving up Fedorov for Eric Lindros? Or for, it was that whole Forsberg-Lindros type of thing. It was for Forsberg. And I said
this was Fedorov for Forsberg.
That was at that time.
I never heard that.
That's how good he was. And we were into the, so it was the whole conversation between what we'd have to pay for Lindros and what we would have had to, Fedorov was the guy because he was, he was probably 22 at the time. And I said, as much as I love Fedorov, I would probably do the deal.
For Forsberg, too.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that was how it.
Oh, so it would have been like a three-way.
Yeah.
But
we never got close.
You were getting Forsberg. Philly was getting Lindros. And Quebec was going to get Fedorov.
Fedorov.
Wow.
There's a great book to be, co-written by Russ Farwell. There's a great book to be written about all the offers that Philadelphia got for him.
Oh, I can't
imagine. Ron did it once on Hockey Night when Lindros was a Leaf on Saturday night. He went through all the offers that the Leafs made and the Rangers made, but I don't remember if Detroit was there or not. But it was a great episode. I remember watching it and going, oh, my God, this is terrific.
That was one of the major decisions I had to make in my coaching career early on.
Yeah.
Is we left Washington, Brian Murray and I, and I was unemployed. Brian was interviewing for jobs, and I'm sitting in my cottage, no jobs. I've got nothing going, and I get a call from Russ Farwell, who had just taken over as a GM in Philly, saying, there's two jobs here, and I'm guaranteeing you one or the other today. I'm guaranteeing you assistant coach in Philly, or head coach in Hershey. So I went in and interviewed, knowing going into the interview I had one or the other, because I had coached in Baltimore the year before, and we played Hershey 12 times.
Skipjacks.
And Frank Mathers was the president and GM of Hershey, and he was a friend of Brian's. And Ed Chenoweth, I had interviewed for the Team Canada job that summer as well, Dave King's job, and Ed Chenoweth had recommended me. So I knew I had either one of the other two. So I end up getting offered the head job in Hershey. And I said to Russ, I just want to go home and talk about it. You know, I'm going to probably take it. And I'm driving to the airport, and Brian Murray phones me, and he said, hey, what's up? And I said, well, I just got offered the Hershey job. And he said, well, I just got the Detroit job. You're coming with me. So all of a sudden, I have no jobs, and then I got two damn jobs. And then I went home that night, and I remember Jill and I saying, oh, do you want to go to Hershey, or do you want to go to this associate coach of Detroit Red Wings? She said, I think I'd just like soon stay in the NHL.
You know, one of your favorite stories about your time in Detroit was when you were fired, and you got a call a day or two later, first thing in the morning.
Yeah. It was amazing. We got fired on a Friday. Brian Murray came in my house. He said, I just got fired. And I said, oh, really? And he said, yeah, and you did too. That's what he said to me. I'll never forget him going in my house. So that was fine. I leave Friday. I get a call on Monday morning at 8 o'clock. And it's Mike Ilitch calling. And Mike Ilitch says, hey, Doug, you got fired Friday. And I said, yeah, I got fired Friday. He said, what's your deal? And I said, I got one more year in my contract. He said, okay, if you don't have a job in a year, I'll hire you back with the Red Wings.
Nice.
Wow. That's what he said to me on the phone. I said, Mr. I said, you won't have to do that, but I'll have a job, but I guarantee you won't have to do that, but I really, really appreciate it. They were special people.
That's outstanding.
Those two guys, yeah. So, anyway.
We're already going late with Doug.
People are asleep. People are asleep at the wheel.
The reason
people
we wanted to have
you. People can't be asleep because you talk too loud.
This is what Jimmy Light said to me one time. I used to do a little radio show when I was with the Red Wings.
Yeah.
And he called me. He said, what about the show? And I said, it's going. He said, we got up our insurance. People are falling asleep on the highway coming into Detroit listening to you. It was like a five-minute show. Jimmy Lights, he was always a comedian, you know?
That's good.
Well, you had a question you wanted
to ask. Well, I wanted to ask about, and you and I have talked about this before, and it's such a wonderful story. And, you know, this is sort of, you know, freelance marketing, I suppose, for our trade deadline coverage. But no move, no trade clauses. You know, scuttle plenty of deals. And it's become a significant, I don't want to say issue, negotiated thing in the NHL. The Todd Marchand situation.
Yeah, ugly.
That was the on-ramp, because no trades had already existed, but that was the on-ramp for the no-move clause.
Yeah.
Take us through that scenario, because that was speaking of Fedorov, that was a Fedorov deal, the Anaheim-Columbus.
Yeah, so Brian Burke and I do the parameters of the deal, and it was Marchand, Tyler Wright, and Francois Beauchemin, who was playing with our farm team in Syracuse. Our guys like Beauch a lot. And it was for Fedorov. And we were trying to even up the money. So Marchand was making 3.5. Tyler was making a little over 1. And Beauchemin, it evened out the money so that the money was even on the deal. So I call Todd Marchand into the office to tell him I was trading him to Anaheim. Because we'd basically done the deal. And he had a
No trade.
No move, but no such thing. He had no trade. And he looked at me across the desk, and I liked Todd. My owner had got a little ugly on him during the lockout because he had said some things, and my owner was really upset, but that was fine. That was another thing. I liked Todd, and he played hard. We had signed him as a free agent, and it was a big deal. He left Edmonton and signed in Columbus. I say, well, I'm trading you to Anaheim, and he looked at me and said, no, you're not. He was a pretty confident guy, Todd.
You know what?
Very confident guy.
I always liked Todd Marchand.
I liked him.
Because if you asked him a question, he gave you an honest answer.
Yes, and his honest answer was, no, you're not trading me to Anaheim. I'm not going.
I like dealing with him.
So I phoned Burke, and I said, Burke, I said, Todd Marchand won't go in the trade. But I said, at that salary and term he's got left, I don't think anybody will take him. So I'm putting him on waivers, and you can take him on waivers. So the trade was Beauchemin and Tyler Wright for Fedorov.
Yeah.
But really, Marchand, and I put Marchand on waivers, and Berkey claimed him. So then I get a league's calling, and the Players Association wanted to do an investigation into this, and media in Columbus, they couldn't figure out why I put him on waivers. Well, it was essentially part of the trade.
Part of the deal.
It was. And that is the reason we have no movement clauses now.
So all those GMs who got screwed in the expansion draft last year are cursing your name.
Yes. But there was an investigation that was found that nothing was...
Yeah, everything's fine.
What do they like? Legal. What's an investigation? What do? They take your phone?
Well, there was a... He went on waivers first.
Yeah.
And nobody took him. Because... Remember you had when you put a guy on a second time, you got him for half price?
Right,
remember
yes.
That was the rule?
Yes, that's right.
So people were cute. I had teams phoning me wanting them, but they wanted me to...
Eat half the salary.
Eat half the salary. And I said, no way. And I phoned Bill Daly. I said, Bill, this is what's going on here, and I don't like it. So then I put him on a second time, and Brian Burton...
And Anaheim grabbed him.
With some persuasion. They, yes. In other words, hey, this, you know.
Well, you made a deal.
Your owner
made a deal. I could just, I wish there was audio of that phone call. Brian, you made a deal.
So there was no, anyway, then that's where the no movement clause. So it was, and you know what? I've talked to Todd since. It was not a fun time. It was a kind of ugly.
You got a Stanley Cup out of it.
I know, but he did not want to leave. He really didn't. And I like Todd.
He's still working for them.
Yeah, and he's a good guy, good quality, good family. It was one of the things if I had to do over, I probably wouldn't have done it, you know?
You know, just before we let you go, one of my highlights every week is show up for work on Wednesday. We have our production meeting a couple hours before the Wednesday night show. Doug comes in, he sits down, he looks at me, goes, Elliot, I saw your blog came out. I skimmed a couple of these. It's too long. Like, you know, I read the first sentence of each one. I'm like, am I getting anything out of this? No, I'm going on to the next one. Yeah, I got like halfway through this one. Like, I have learned that if Doug comes to me and says, I got halfway through it, yeah, that is an exceptionally good piece of writing.
That's further than Kyprios gets.
I have no doubt that.
As I've said to you on numerous occasions, it should be called 31 Essays.
That's right.
But I try to encourage him. I used to really, yeah, like when he'd put it, like I just make a point, and then it would be a really intriguing two sentences, and then it would grab me, and I think, okay, I'm anxious to know the rest of this story. But he just goes into so much depth and background. It's more. I did a master's at Western. I've never written essays like that.
It should be shorter now because he has a podcast to get the rest of his opinions out. But
I'm kidding. I enjoy it more than Kyprios.
Well, listen. We thank you.
You know, that's like jumping over a matchbox.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
See you tonight.
Very much.
No, you'll be good luck with the podcast. I hear just wonderful things about it.
Well, it'll be over.
Because you haven't listened, yeah, right?
I'm going to, though. Yeah. Not this show, but I'll listen to a future one.
Get out of here.
Thanks, Doug.
Sportsnet.ca is the home of hockey. Breakaways and breaking trades. Catch highlights, news, and expert analysis from the best in the business. Featuring award-winning authors and must-read weekly features like Elliot Friedman's 31 Thoughts and Quick Shifts by Luke Fox. From the morning skate to the opening face-off, Canada's deepest roster of sports writers all in one place. Visit sportsnet.ca, the home of hockey.
Okay, Elliot, it's always fun talking to Doug. Doug may be one of the most misunderstood people in all of hockey broadcasting. I can recall not knowing what to expect the first time I worked with him. I thought, okay, here comes angry, cranky, cantankerous Doug McLean. Couldn't have been a nicer guy. And couldn't have been a funnier guy.
People play certain roles, right? Like, in some ways, what we do is acting.
100%.
And Bob McCowan is one of the biggest actors that I ever met, and I say that as a compliment. Earlier in my career, Bob sat me down and he gave me some advice, and he said, you know, one of the things you're going to have to decide is, are you comfortable playing certain roles that you might not normally be willing to do? And I said I wasn't, and he said, then you're never going to be as good on sports radio as you could be. And he was right. And now when I go on The Fan, I will do things that I won't do on Hockey Night in Canada. Like, I hold Hockey Night in Canada to an exalted position. I don't want to ruin it. But when I go on The Fan, I'll do things because I'm more comfortable in my own skin now at 47 than when I was 25. But I look at Doug, and he is playing a bit of a role. He's playing a bit of a character. And people think that that character is who he is. It's not. Now, he's doing it for a reason, and I think it's really funny. There's times when the camera's not on me where I can't stop laughing because of the insanity of what he's arguing. But, you know, he's playing a bit of a shtick, and he's great at it. And we, as you know, Jeff, in the business, need people like that, because if everybody was like us, sports media would be boring as sin.
Oh, yes, it would. And one of the other great roles in this one, and it's always interesting to see how people handle it on both sides of the microphone, is the walk-off interview.
Yeah.
You've done tons of these.
Yes.
I've done, you know, numerous walk-off interviews as well. And for me, I love Gene Principe.
Yep,
he's great. I love Gene. Does the Edmonton Oilers games with us at Sportsnet. And everyone always tries to find, you know, their perfect match for the walk-off interview or the perfect symbiotic relationship between broadcaster and athlete. Howard Cosell and Muhammad Ali, I mean, that was music.
The
that
best.
The finest.
Michael Jordan, Ahmad Rashad. Like, fantastic. People made fun of Rashad about that, but they had a great relationship.
The one great relationship we see with the Oilers and Gene is Pat Maroon.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever, you know, I throw back and doing the intermissions, you know, throw back to the rink and I see that it's Gene and Pat Maroon, I know we're going to get something good. This is from a couple of weeks ago. I've wanted to play this on the podcast now for a couple of weeks. This is the Oilers midway through a big slump in the intermission. And this is Patrick. I love this interview. This is Patrick Maroon talking to Gene Principe.
Jeff, a heck of a finish and I guess in some ways a heck of a start, an unexpected one. What did you just sort of make out of the way that period went?
Yeah, obviously they got off to a good start. They got off 2-0, but I just feel like, Gene, it's been like that all year. And we're a team that's been fighting through it, but we have a good group of guys here, and this is a team that believes in the locker room. And you just showed it out there. You know, we came back and battled hard to tie this hockey game, and we did a really good job of that.
You just kind of motioned to your lip there. Yeah. Walk us through an elbow. Not a great way to start the play, but a good way to finish it with a goal.
Yeah, you know, obviously I was looking for the call there. It just seems like it's been going the other way for me, Gene. I've been on the other side of those, and I take the penalty. But, you know, Connor is an elite player, and you can see right here what he does right here with his work. And Clough bomb made a heck of a play. And, you know, I haven't been going to the net as much this year, Gene. And for me, I just got to get back to that. You know, I've been talking to myself about that, just going back to the net, and hopefully good things start to come my way again.
Well, what's it like to have a veteran presence like Al Montoya come in and just settle everything down after a difficult start?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? It's not Talbot's fault, Gene. I think, you know, we've all been going through this tough spot here. And, you know, Talbot's has been one of our best players the last 2 years. So, you know, he's been doing a really good job for us this year. And a veteran goalie like Al puts us in a good situation where we know he can come in and make some key saves at some key times. So, you know, we're happy that he's back with us and he's in the net tonight.
Patrick, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Gene.
Patrick Maroon helping the Edmonton Oilers finish up this period. Tied 3-1. Interesting 20 minutes between Maroon and the Oilers and the Coyotes.
Now, we've had both done interviews that we've particularly enjoyed and others have been torturous. The walk-off is always tough because the player is tired, sweaty, just wants to get into the room and just wants to get it over with. What I love about that interview is, well, first of all, Gene's a very gracious host. And two, Maroon wants to give him something.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell that he wants to say something. And he said, listen, if I'm going to stand here and do this interview, I don't want this just to be cliche after cliche. And the one thing that I always pick up on and notice is he says Gene's name.
Yes.
I know it's a small thing, but it's huge. Every year there's a group of hockey players that I talk to for one particular agency. And they bring
Which
me
agency
into
is it?
Or group. There you go. So I talk to Or Group kids every year. And they bring me in to talk about media, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing that I always tell these kids, a lot of this is a commercial for yourself. A lot of this is marketing for yourself. And the one thing you can do is be respectful to the person that you're talking to and say their name, right? Tiny little thing. If you're doing a radio interview, you know, write down the host and the co-host's name on a piece of paper and reference them when you're speaking. It'll buy you a lot of grace. It'll buy you a lot of respect from those broadcasters if you have the respect enough to say their name. You know who did that when he was with – I remember this going away. I was blown away by it. When he was in junior hockey, now in the NHL, and he may win the Calder Trophy this year, it's Matthew Barzal.
Mm-hmm.
Barzal has always, the times that I dealt with him when he was with Seattle Thunderbirds, he was always like that. What did you make of the Pat Maroon, Gene Principe piece?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, it is very clear, as you said, Gene has the respect of the Edmonton Oilers and the people he talks to. And that goes a million miles. They know him. They like him. They think they're going to get a fair shake from him. They trust him. That automatically means that Gene is going to get more out of guys than most people, especially around Edmonton. So that's half the battle. The second thing is recognizing the mood of the player. Like, you know, when you ask for somebody and you see them come out to you, do they look at you? Is their head down? Do they roll their eyes? And at that moment, you know kind of where you're going, and you have to make sure you adjust to that mood.
Mm-hmm.
Thirdly, and I always tell people, you can have the best prepared interview of your life, but if the guest isn't going to help, there's nothing you can do about it. People say that 9 times out of 10, an interview is ruined by the questions. I disagree with that. I think an interview can be helped by the questions, for sure. If you make an athlete or somebody think, I think it automatically improves things. But if the athlete decides that they don't want to think and they just want to get through this right away, there's nothing you're going to be able to do. So think about all these things. You've got a respected commentator in Edmonton, Principe. You've got a guy who's in a playful mood, Maroon, and a guy who wants to give you something. I think if you're in that situation and you're the interview, you blow it if it goes wrong. And they didn't. And, you know, at the end of the day, everybody wants to make things easy on everybody else, right? The interviewer wants a good interviewer. The athlete wants, you know, a good time. They don't want to see it as a chore every time they're talking to you. And you know what? The audience loves that stuff because they aren't expecting a lot in intermission interviews. So if you give them something different, they love it. And I agree with you, Jeff, 100% on one thing. If you are an athlete, and sometimes you're going to do interviews and you're going to be pissed off or mad or you're losing or whatever, but the more you can smile and just give a little something,
mm-hmm.
it's a great commercial for yourself.
And I can't tell you how many hockey players, even just we've spoken to here at Sportsnet, that have come through to work as analysts who now start to understand this side of the business a little bit more and understand the audience a little more and understand hockey media a little bit more, who always arrive at one of the same conclusions. I wish I would have had more fun with those interviews. I didn't know I was allowed. I didn't know that I was allowed to be playful or be a goofball a little bit. I remember P.K. Subban once asking Scott Oak how my suit was. Now, of course, that's P.K., so you sort of expect it. I remember I was watching that with one of our analysts, and he said, man, I wish I knew I was allowed to do stuff like that.
Well,
I wish someone would have told me I was allowed to goof around a little bit. I would thought I was just there for cliches and 110% and all the answers are in that room.
Well, like I said to you, we talked about this last week. I think it's changing. I think the next generation of people is going to change that just because they don't see it that way like it used to be seen. And I hope that's the case. I think hockey has great personalities. I think social media has alerted us to a side of a lot of these guys that we never knew existed.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what, Jeff? We just have to keep kicking down that door. Like, you and I, and Emil, who's sitting here watching us, we all take our jobs very seriously. You know, you expect to do a good job. I expect to do a good job. I know Emil holds himself to a high standard when he puts together this show. But that doesn't mean you can't have fun doing it. You know, there are going to be times when you have bad days, like bad games, and you don't feel like having fun, but you still got to get out of bed and do your job, right? And I think in the NHL, we're getting to that place where guys can balance the fun with the professionalism of the job. I think we're getting there.
Fingers crossed. Let's get to some hashtag Ask31s here.
Shoot, hit me.
As we finish a few things up here. By the way, on your point about San Jose next year, Owen Nolan's got to be there for the point.
For sure.
For the point. He's got to do the point. And if you can do whatever you can to have a Dominic
Hasek back.
Dominic Hasek versus Owen Nolan.
Maybe
next
you do
year.
Save streak, and at the end you show this video on the highlight and you roll the two of them out.
There you go. By the way, just a quick aside. The end of the podcast last week, this is really sneaky, by the way. At the end of the podcast last week, you said, let us know whether you think this podcast is too long. It took me a while, but I realized why that's maybe the sneakiest thing you've done early on in this podcast. Because overwhelmingly, people responded by saying, no, the podcast is not too long. No way, we love it long. But the only people that are going to respond are the people that have gone the entire way with it.
What's the name of the woman who tweeted that?
Karen Douglas.
No. I know who Karen is
because
she always tweets at me all the time.
Yeah.
But she's a professional. I think she has a podcast of her own. I wanted to send her a direct message, but she doesn't follow me. And but you follow her, and she said that exact same thing. She said you're going to have confirmation bias in your tweets because most of the people who follow you will get there right to the end. But you know what's interesting? Like, people brought up Joe Rogan to me. I guess he does like a three-hour podcast.
Oh, his marathon podcast, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you're interested, you're interested, which we appreciate.
We do, but I thought that was very clever of you, by the way, to bury that at the end of the podcast. We're the only people that were going to...
I wasn't thinking about that. Like, I'm not that smart.
Hashtag Ask31. I need Elliot, and this might be for a longer piece, but I need Elliot to expand in his support for Sergei Zubov in the Hall of Fame.
Look, he was a great player. I think he was underappreciated. He got lost a bit because he didn't like the attention, and maybe because he played in Dallas after some of their best years. To me, Sergei Zubov was a game-changing defenseman, and I think he should be in the Hall of Fame, no questions asked. I mean, I don't know what else there is to say there. I mean, like, is there a better defenseman who's not in the Hall of Fame who's eligible right now?
No, and when I think of Sergei Zubov, I think of puck on a string between him and Brian Leetch in 94.
Yeah.
Which was spectacular.
You know, remember, regular season that year was the Rangers' leading scorer.
You know what he's in the conversation for? The greatest defenseman to never win the Norris Trophy.
Yes. You know, Shea Weber's in that conversation. Ryan Suter is in that conversation, and Zubov is too. But I think that's one of those things where the way the public sees him and the way the players see him, there's a gulf. I think the public respects him, but I think the players knew, and I think he should be in the Hall of Fame.
All right.
Slam dunk.
That one came to us from Randy Lewis. Randy, thank you for that. This one comes to us from Peter Lagus. Every year around trade deadline, there is a buzz of big deals being done, but they never materialize. Do you guys expect more of the same this trade deadline season? Trade deadline versus tweak deadline, Elliot.
I hate making that prediction simply because I hate to be wrong. Peter, I think at this point in time, the supply is above the demand. Like, there's scorers out there. There's Hoffman. There's Pacioretty. There's Evander Kane. I'm sure I'm missing some guys. And there's Rick Nash. There's Grabner. Maybe there's a Zuccarello. We don't know 100% yet, but it's possible. How many teams are actually chasing these guys at this point in time? Plus, there's Tavares hanging over all of it. And I don't think he's getting traded, but, you know, I think people are kind of just making sure. They don't want to say, We didn't know. So I just think right now the supply is out front of the demand. I do think there's going to be a big name or two that goes, though. And I always believe, Peter, I always believe that there's a bomb that we don't see.
Julian Kretinsky, other than Vegas, what was, for you, the biggest surprise of the first half of the season? For me, Boston.
Colorado. Boston's up there. And for the other reasons, like Edmonton, Chicago.
Am I allowed to say I saw Chicago coming and talked about it last year?
No, you know, you were one of the only guys who picked Nashville in that series, so I think you can legitimately say that. I would say my biggest surprise has been Colorado. Now it looks like they're going to be without Nathan MacKinnon for a couple of games. So,
do we have an update on that? I didn't see anything today yet so far.
Jared Bednar said that after the game last night and again this morning, apparently on a radio hit, that he won't play tomorrow in Edmonton. They'll know more in 24 hours, but I think they're expecting him to miss a couple of games. However, it appears it's not as bad as they originally feared.
The woman in question, by the way, this is from Emil, who does research for us now, too. @HollyGoDarkly. Thank you, Erica.
Yes, Erica. That was her name. I should have remembered that because that's one of my sister's names. But I appreciate it because she was talking about confirmation bias, which is true. You know, Emilia, you don't get a raise for doing research, too, just so you know that.
Yeah, don't expect anything extra in your envelope this week. Sorry, bud. From Tony Vandenhoevel, you will know about things like this from covering other sports. Will there ever come a time when a franchise player status is implemented in the NHL where one player's salary is not counted against the cap?
I have asked this question before, and the league is dead set against it because it counts as basically a cap breaker. You no longer have a hard cap if you're allowing that.
Eon G submits, is the smaller goalie equipment proposal dead? You know what's one of the nice things that's happened this year? We haven't had the conversation about, is the goalie equipment too big? Honestly, everyone listening right now, how many times have you had that conversation this season? I'm guessing the answer is less than one.
Yes, it is definitely less than one.
No one's having the conversation this year. You know why? I think it's because of the zero tolerance on the slashing has allowed players to get in scoring positions.
Yes.
And get in positions where they can get their shot off, have some time, have accuracy, have some strength in your wrist because you're not getting chopped to make shots. Maybe, just maybe the idea that goaltending equipment is too big was a myth the whole time.
No, I don't believe that. I don't think it was a myth. But, you know, hey, how many times have we gone down this road and you don't get there? Because, and goalies will tell you it's a minority, but it's a vocal minority, and they put up a fight and they get their way.
We'll finish on this one. Mark Carvello, this is an interesting one. Hashtag Ask31. Have either of you ever been offered a job by an NHL club? And if so, which club and for what role?
Have you?
Yes. Once. It was a weird conversation. It was 2 years ago. And it was very indirect.
It was like tampering.
What's
remember we had that conversation? Was it you had that conversation with tampering with? You get your friend to call my friend, so technically we don't talk to each other.
It was our owner's interested in having a conversation with you to see if there's a fit.
I guess the best way to answer this is I had one team ask me if I ever thought I could be a general manager. And I said no. And they go, why not? I said to them that after I got hired by Hockey Night in Canada, my knowledge of the game grew a ton because I watched practices with guys like Glenn Healy and Greg Millen and Kelly Rudy. Those were the guys that were there.
Goalies.
When I got hired, yes. Craig Simpson was another guy great to watch practice with.
That, by the way, just as an aside, we get afforded a lot of luxuries that other hockey fans don't get a chance to. Being able to watch a practice with an ex-NHLer is gold.
Or a game with Adam Oates. Like, gold. I have to tell you, watching a game with Adam Oates is really something. And I realized how much I didn't know. Like, these guys, they just see the game at a level I can't see it. Mm-hmm. Now, one thing I do believe now is I believe managing is more important than everything. You have to know how to manage people, probably even more now than scouting. I hate to say that, but I think it's probably true. But I think if you're going to be a successful manager, you have to have an eye for the subtle things of the game. And I have learned that while my eye is good, it is not good enough. And I don't think they were ever going to interview me. I think it was more like they were just asking me, you know, did I ever see that? Although I have wondered about where the conversation would go. I just said, I don't think I would be a good hire for you, for anyone. I don't think I'm a general manager. But I have been asked twice by teams if I would be interested in joining the organization in a combined media / hockey role. And I said, if I was to ever join a team, I want to learn the business. I want to learn how you run hockey ops. I want to learn how you run the business in addition to working in the media for your organization. But it never went anywhere.
The real answer that Elliot
I love my job.
The real answer that Elliot wants to say is he can't afford the pay cut.
That's not true.
And that will wrap. On behalf of Elliot Friedman, our producer, Emil Delich, thanks so much for downloading and listening to this podcast. We're back in 7 days with more 31 Thoughts. Thanks for joining us.